everybody, or good afternoon, everybody, whenever it is you get your podcast fix. My name is Derek Smith, and this is the Truth or Derek Show, or the Truth or Derek Podcast, the Truth or Derek sitting around rambling about nonsense, which, hey, let's face it, that's what podcasting is. So much cool stuff happening, a lot of excitement happening around here. You guys love Joseph Scott Morgan. And it actually got us a whole bunch of, we got a new family to welcome into the TRD podcast army, Florida. That was the most downloaded spot. I know he's from down there with the University of Jacksonville and whatnot. So yes, welcome to all of our Floridian download people. We love you. Talkative bunch too, because we got a ton of cool feedback and a ton of really cool questions. We got back. I'm sorry about the delay the last 2 weeks. I know I keep saying the episodes are coming, but there was a problem with the cloud, like the internet cloud, not the clouds in the sky. They're fine. Speaking of the clouds in the sky, do you want to take your podcasting career to the next level or the next cloud with www.podstars.net? Podstars is a talented and passionate community that will give you the opportunity to interview top professionals from a variety of industries where they will share their insights and experiences with your audience. Plus, everybody will have access to the exclusive celebrity catalog featuring some of the best in the business, both new and established. It's also free to join. As a member of Podstars, you can choose from the catalog of celebrities to interview on your podcast, and if interested, for only an additional monthly fee of $8.99 a month, you can upgrade to the Community Plan, a completely different and exciting catalog full of some of the best experts and professionals in their fields today, as well as access to everybody in the whole Podstars universe. It is a great way to invest in your podcast, as you will save time and money by being able to book guests from one platform with an expansive catalog that is constantly being added to. And that was part of our big announcement, is next week, international supermodel and actress Danielle Vasanova is coming. And she's on the site. Josh is on the site. Franzi's on the site. They're all on the site. So why wait? Join www.podstars.now. and start exploring all that they have to offer. You will not want to miss out on this amazing opportunity to elevate your podcasting career and be a part of the exciting community. And an exciting community it is. Let me tell you, I'm deep in there and loving every minute of it. As I mentioned, we'll go through some of the other downloads and some of our new TRD family. Maybe today or the next one, because I got a ton of stuff I got to get to. I know I got all your questions, as always. Reach out to me on Twitter at Derek Vampire Slayer. Shoot me an email, podstars.connect@outlook.com. Or just Google the Truth or Derek Show. There's all those different ways you can send messages and all that sort of thing. And you can eventually track me down. I'm on Instagram, too. I'm not great with that, but I'm sure if you send me a message, I'll see it. But some of our new people, one of them, I guess he just listened to that one. And, you know, Joseph Scott Morgan had like a, I don't want to say a serious approach to it, but he had like a very kind of serious delivery. So I guess one of the listeners heard that and shot over like a serious question, which, because, you know, I always joke and I'm like, well, you know, we're handing out advice here on the TRD show and we're doing this and we're doing that. So he didn't leave his name. He just said from Florida, I hate my boss. what do you think I should do? And I was like, listen, I shot him a message back personally and I told him I'll talk about it. But, you know, a lot of people will just say, oh, you know, quit your job, go get another one, or, you know, that sort of thing, where that is not helpful advice, because, you know, if you're like 90% of the world, we all need, we need money. That's the bottom. Everyone's always like, you know, profit's a bad word. You're like, no, if you're going to drag yourself into work for, you know, 10 hours a day and an hour commute, you're going to sit in traffic and do this and do that. Yes, you want to get paid at the end of the week, at the end of every 2 weeks. Like, come on, that's, you know, I hate my job, but I like living indoors and I like being able to buy food. So the advice that I gave him was like, it sucks, because I've had that. I've had a horrible boss. I've had a few horrible bosses and I've had a few horrible coworkers. And it, yeah, there's an old saying, you know, it was like they talked about it in, How I Met Your Mother, when you get like graduation goggles. Once you know the end of school's coming, it's not so bad. With the, you know, people or that you go to school with, you're not going to have to see them again. And you can kind of use that advice when it comes to that sort of thing. So you have to look at the big picture. You know, is this person going to be your boss in a year, in 2 years, in 5 years? Because as soon as you can figure that out, you know, maybe it's a smaller company and, you know, you are looking for something else, but you just don't want to leave just yet, or you can't make that move just yet, but you will. So in your head, you say, okay, listen, my boss is an asshole, but I've only got to put up with this for another 8 months. In my opinion, as soon as you figure that out in your head, it kind of like starts a countdown. So it's not that bad. I mean, it's bad, but at least you know that this isn't going to be what the rest of your life is like. Like, I told a story a few episodes back when I worked at Eaton's and I had just this douche, this real asshole coworker, Paul. And one of those guys that would just make life miserable every chance he got. Not on purpose. He was just that kind of guy. And I ended up shooting my mouth off to him when I found out that Sears was buying the company and that I was going to get like a middle kind of executive job. And that ended up costing me the whole thing. So that was not the way to handle it, you know. But I was younger then, you know, young and crazy. And now it's like, you know, think the whole thing over. You know, you can't go in just because you hate your boss and quit tomorrow morning. And then all of a sudden, you know, you had no money to go grocery shopping in 2 weeks. I get it. So definitely just think of what the long picture is. You know, is he going to be your boss in a year? If not, wait for it. If it's one of those things where you can't leave right now, but you will be able to in 6 months or a year, then work on it with that. But, you know, I've talked about myself having crazy hothead moments all the time. So it seems weird to tell somebody else to chill. But listen, man, just chill. Think of the big picture. Think of what the next logical move is going to be and how long it is. And I promise you, as soon as you make that decision in your head, the rest of it's going to be a little bit better. Another great question. Jesse wrote in a bunch. I know we asked Franz and Josh a bunch of them. We actually have them on 2 episodes this week. So if you like your a heaping spoonful of Josh and Franz, you're going to get it. Again, Jesse wrote in another one from Florida. What is the best... What job are you best at and what are you worst at? I can tell you, and my wife would agree, my worst quality is starting stuff and not finishing it. And it goes like across the board, whether it's home renovation stuff, just I can show you a million things around here. Like, you know, and 90% of it, even when I built a swimming pool in my backyard and that was 90% done for 5 years. I built a deck 2 years ago, which the permit's going to run out soon, and that's 90% done. Just the partial kitchen reno, my back room, I had to move my washer dryer, that's 90% done. It's like I could take these huge chunks out of stuff, and then after that it just mellows out. I've tried to get better on that, though. So yeah, definitely worst at finishing stuff. Getting that first 90, you know, he's a football player. I can get the ball down to the 1 yard line, but I ain't scoring no touchdowns. What am I best at? You know what? I enjoy like around the house chores. You know, most people would say like, you know, it's not the woman's job, but it, you know, usually in a household, that job of dishes, laundry, that sort of thing. You know, where me particularly, I think there's something like satisfying about like loading up a really filthy, greasy dishwasher, emptying it out. Because we cook a lot here up at Camp Derrick, so I usually have like a load of dishes, and there's just the two of us. I can usually, we have a full dishwasher every day almost, if not for sure every other day. But yeah, doing laundry, pulling that out, even folding laundry, love it. Again, putting it away, not always. Like I often have the laundry basket with the clean folded clothes in it, like just sitting on the bed, and I'll move it out of the way when I go to bed. And put that off, but obviously that ties into what I'm not good at. Even when we first bought the house, because we had, you know, pretty much blown our life savings and everything on it, as soon as we moved in, the whole washing machine broke, and we were like working crazy hours in. So like we get back, and again we just tell these stories where I sound like a degenerate alcoholic, but because we were working 6 days a week, like 14 hours a day, you didn't really have a lot of time to chill or have a drink, relax, that sort of thing. But, you know, I'd come home, I'd gather up 2 or 3 loads of laundry and I'd go to the laundromat. I'm one of the few people that likes the laundromat, that they have the big machines and you can kind of get all that work done kind of in one shot. And you'd be over there for an hour, so you could bring a few beers with you and, you know, something to read, bring your phone, whatever, and just hang out. But even then, you know, I could load it up. I could drive to the laundromat. I could do all that. I could fold it. I could put it back. I could bring it home and bring it in the house, but I wouldn't put it away. So, yeah, around the house stuff, I would say that I'm the best at. Again, love doing dishes. I love cooking, all that sort of thing. I'm a catch. You guys watch out. I'm a sweet catch. I had another question from John in Florida. Said, do you like flying? And what was the worst flight you've ever been on? I hate flying. I don't know anyone who does. I know my my niece just got a job as a flight attendant. And I was like, that would just be my idea of hell, just getting off one airplane and onto another one. Yeah, I've never really had a bad flight. I mean, I've had a little bit of turbulence and stuff like that. And somebody sitting behind me that had horrid body odor. I think I talked about it my last one when I was coming back from the Dominican Republic. I had paid for the extra legroom seat and all that, but like where they had jammy, it was right like a window seat. And I don't get the whole window seat fascination because like you don't see anything. You see the ground when you take off and you see the ground when you land. And that's what, a minute and a half. The rest of it's just sky and cloud. But I don't know, the way it was designed, like my head was all cranked over and the little fan they had wasn't working and the whole thing was just ugh. But you know, it's the destination. You can't exactly, you know, I can't drive to the Bahamas, so I have to suckle at American Airlines teat, which again I'm fine with. You know, again, I don't like it. I think I talked about it before we were going on the way to the Bahamas, and I was smart because I'd kind of stayed up all night the night before, like I was dead tired. And as soon as I got on the plane, they sat us next to a woman that had two newborn babies, and I was just thinking to myself, oh, this is going to be hell. And then boom. Sleep, and when I woke up, we were landing in the Bahamas. They were very well-behaved children, and I was just out like, I always did, the one thing I enjoyed, though, when people do that pilot's voice, there's something so calming, because they usually have, like, a little bit of a sense of humor. I remember when, on the way to the Dominican Republic, it was raining, and the pilot, you know, they come on, they're like, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We are experiencing a 15-minute delay. I'd like to say it's because of the weather, but hey, you know, it's just one of those days. Just sit tight, buckle up, and we'll be on our way in a minute. Which is one of those things, because, like, again, I don't like flying, but knowing that the guy up there is all calm and all that, like, if the guy came on and he's like, I'm sorry, you know, there's a little bit of a delay, but as soon as we get the people on, we're going to take this and we're going to take off. And you're like, well, what the fuck? If this guy's stressed out, like, what is it? Is this his second flight? I'm actually glad they don't tell you that, because these people must be taking a first flight at some point. You know, you don't want to know that. You want that guy up there as, how's everybody doing today? You know, we're going to increase this. That was the other thing. I remember it was a Seinfeld joke. And they're like, we're going to increase the speed so we can get there on time. And you know, I'm thinking to myself, why aren't you going full speed the whole time so we can get there? Like, what, are we taking the scenic route? You tell me that you can get me to Vegas in 2 hours instead of four. Like, you know, what are we doing here? Come on, get your head in the game. I should try that. I'll try to do it on the next episode. I'll see if I can read the Podstars ad, the opening ad in my pilot's voice. Hello, everybody. Where did you take your career to the next level with www.podstars.net? I'm going to do that. Anyways, I know I did. I was going to jam in some of my slow motion stuff, but I actually did that in the episode with Josh and Franz, so I don't want to step all over my own bit. But yeah, let's get to it. We talked about some amazing stuff. Let's Josh and Franz it up again. Tomorrow there's going to be another Josh and Franz, and next week, big episode. In the meantime, let's go. Oh, my God. The fun we're going to have. You guys like Josh. You like friends. He is one of the best attorneys in Baton Rouge. Well, heck, at all of the USA. He's a regular on Court TV as well as various other news outlets. He's also on Talk 107.3 with Brian Haldane. He visits churches. He's great on Twitter. He is the fantastic Franz Borghardt alongside a TRD podcast Hall of Famer. The Pride of Atlanta, also tearing it up on Court TV, CNN, Atlanta News First, and a million other places. You know him as one of the smartest people in show business. You know him from being amazing on social media. You know him as the incredible Joshua Schiffer. What's happening, fellas?
Hey, I've grown some hair. This is my new look.
Is it a comb over if you take it and
Comb
Well,
under.
yeah, no, I figure if they stare at this incredible, luxurious beard, they can't pay attention to the fats.
The podcast comes out first. People are listening to your beard. They're not looking at it.
Imagine me in a luxurious gray beard. It's smooth and has very few bananas sticking in it.
You look like you're on your way back to the Shire to get Frodo to go do some work.
That's my jam, man.
So
that's my line. Whenever I'm at the bar, it's always like, hey, baby, want to go back to the Shire?
Works every time.
Works every time. Shire and some Colt 45.
So it's funny you say that, because recently...
Let me tell you how that involves my life. I'm from...
No. And she will remain nameless. Someone dear to me in my life made a comment about how bristly my goatee is and that I needed to groom it, like as in like oil and brush it as if I was a stallion horse. And so I found myself recently seeing your beautiful beard, and only the viewers can see the beard. Seeing your beautiful beard, I found myself recently shopping for a beard brush, which, as you know, I haven't had to buy a comb or a brush in quite some time. So,
Mr. Borghardt, it's so good to see you again. We thought you'd never be back.
We thought you had the cancer. You're alive.
Baton Rouge brush and lube. They were just about to fall apart without the funds business.
Let me say, I find it.
I have my frequent buyer card from 1997. Is it still good?
I find it oddly relaxing to oil and brush facial hair.
I had for many years a horrible mustache. And at some point, as all mustache wearers do, you grow it really long so you can wax it just so that you can be that guy. It's really fun and a great fidget thing when you have, like, I totally would just sit there. Problem is, the maintenance on that is, I'm not good at that stuff. And with the wax and all this, and then once the wax goes weird,
Look, as you both know, when I get into something, I deep dive. There is a beard facial hair culture and regimen, like, that deals with exfoliating the skin of the facial hair so it can grow out. It's cutting it like a bush. You groom it and cut it back to where it can grow more fully. I mean, it is
insane. You gotta
get
the line, and you can get the pattern that you put on to make sure. I will say, when I used to shave my head many, many years ago, I did buy that really fancy razor that goes on your fit, and you just do this, and that thing's awesome. Like, that totally was worth the $15 for that.
Franz and I were talking just before we started recording about wrestling. If you want to do a perfect goatee, Franz, you have to do what Triple H does, because every time you look, he's just mesmerizing to look at with his facial hair.
You know, if I had to pick between going on a date with Triple H and Martha Stewart, that's a hard one. That's hard. That's
right.
Really hard.
Before we talk about the news, you guys asked me for something next week. Franz was talking about something, and Josh said, can we please grab that, clip it, and play it back slow? So I've done that. So give me a second here.
And one of almost psychological disadvantage, because you're coming to an attorney in a time of need, and you're at a psychological disadvantage. We're not supposed to diddle our clients.
Oh, diddle our clients. We actually have to take a test on this.
Unless there's a pre-existing diddling relationship that exists.
All about your diddle timing.
Oh, so you're allowed to stick your wife or girlfriend if they get in trouble, but
another 30
no,
seconds.
No, doesn't even have to be a girlfriend.
Oh, that is the line.
It's a standard that it doesn't exist. If you have a pre-existing sexual relationship with an individual, not...
Ladies and gentlemen, this is your lawyer.
Not...
the whole show. Just the whole show.
Not wife, not girlfriend, not any partner, whatever.
That is a voicemail from 1997. 3 o'clock in the morning.
Oh, man.
That's what that sounds like.
Oh, it's good stuff. It's good stuff. So, we can talk a little bit about next week, because I know we've been talking that we're going to be joined with a fourth person. Danielle Vasanova is going to join us, so that'll be interesting. I've never actually done an interview with four people before, but I know you guys have, so maybe we can walk each other through it.
I'm all about foursomes.
Lord. Yeah, it'll be great. I think it's going to be really fascinating for her to have three dumb mama just sitting there being like, uh-huh, yep, uh-huh, yeah, you're
amazing. Good idea. Well said.
Yeah. Yes. Please tell us again how smart and wonderful. And yeah, it's going to be.
I'm going to pose the question now. And I want to pose the question to her. And we talked about that for the listeners and viewers. We talked about this morning. I really want to know the stupid shit she spends money on.
Oh, yeah. No.
Totally. You know what? I want to know the stupid shit if she eats trash food. Because I know I've heard interviews with you know, models and people that work hard and that are in that type of business where it's like, in a day, you can have a 5 ounce steamed piece of fish, a scoop of rice, and a little bit of lettuce.
But man, you've known those people that can just eat anything and always be skinny. And yeah. Just the way, especially people under the age of, say, 35 or 40. Like, it just changes when you get to a certain age. But she seems fascinating to me. I'm thrilled that you can have contact with. Man, I can't wait to talk to her. It's going to be fascinating.
It is going to be a hoot. What is not a hoot right now? It is going on with
great segue.
Crumbly. So, a lot of people out there might not know, but this asshole is now in double trouble because he's been shooting his mouth off from prison. Is the Coles Notes version of it? Now, you guys have probably.
What did he do?
You guys, I guess he was of his death threats from a prison phone. So if you come across this before where it's, you know, I see again, a lot of the cases in the news and stuff, you see the people that are, you know, this is going to court years and years after the crime or something like that. If you're representing somebody where you're during the whole thing or during the investigation, is there a point where you say, like, don't say anything, don't call anybody?
The first time they walk into the damn office.
Never underestimate the power of stupidity.
Yeah.
I can only imagine how many times Josh says it. I say it over and over. Anything you say on the phone is being recorded. Anything you say on the
corner. Everything you talk about on the phone is recorded. You can't use a code that they haven't heard. If you're talking about roses or CD, man, they know what you're talking about. There are programs that they literally run the transcripts through that automatically translate it, write it down, and highlight, that looks like a gangster word right there. And guess what? They ain't programmed by gangsters. They're programmed by prosecutors. So everything is suspicious. And they will spend a million years going through these tapes in order to get the evidence to drop on Franz. And I go, sure, you still want to go to trial? Here's some jail tapes for it. And like, you just want to cry when you see him smiling, because they will literally say to their loved ones the most inculpatory shit in the world. There's a warning when they get on the phone. This is all tape. This is not private. Everybody's listening to this.
You really
this is
going to your parents
and the judge. And they will still insist on saying patently indefensible and unwise things.
I had a murder case in a neighboring parish. It was the best jury selection performance I've ever done. Like, I had 12 people that were eating out of my hands during jury selection. It was a good tribal case. There were good facts for us. I was like, I felt warm and squishy. Show up the second day and the sheriff goes, hey, I got some new evidence for you. And I said, like, hell, you have new evidence. We're in the middle of a trial. You don't have new evidence.
We're done.
Yeah, it was my client who was soliciting the murder of a material witness. And at that point, we then pled out to a very large number. And we're just sitting there and he's like, I don't know what you're talking about. And we played it for him. He goes, oh yeah, that's me. I'm like, yeah no shit.
The one of those that I'm most pissed off about and terrified, we had a case where it was several young men that were allegedly part of an informal organization, not sponsored by anybody.
A club. A club.
Yeah, it's a club. Hey. It's a fraternity. It's a group. So it's a den, you could say. But they happened to beat a man and steal some stuff from him in a park. So my guy gets locked up and he decides he's going to talk with the girlfriend, who is the least gangstery girl, straight out of Central Casting, just a nice, innocent, like 22-year-old, like kindergarten teacher. Like, I really think she worked in like daycare. And while on the phone with her POS boyfriend, he starts saying, yeah, and I've got that chopper, and ends up being, you know, peacocking to, I guess, impress the girl. All she says on the recording is like, uh-huh, a couple times when he's talking about stuff. It was enough to get a warrant. She gets locked up on some gangstery spoken stuff, you know, party to a crime. That it's a real charge. They've got a basis for it. It was dumb. We ended up getting it worked out. But this poor lady's entire life was basically paused, ripped into shreds. I reassembled it and then pushed her back on her way, all because of 30 seconds on a phone with her idiot new boy or boyfriend from the jail.
So was the recorded statement that our favorite son of Michigan is accused of saying, was it hyperbolic? Was it like, man, I could kill that guy? Or was it like, no, really, we need to kill this witness so he never shows up to court? I mean, because there's hyperbole, right? There's euphemisms like, man, I hate that judge. I could kill that judge.
Shannon got hammered for that in the trial. Remember the I'm just going to kill myself line? Yeah, which everybody freaked out about.
I still stand behind my position that she got an entirely unfair shake on social media. Like I have a law school class that were like going off on her. And I was like, well, first of all, put a microphone and a camera in your face for a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, and see how great you look at the end of that.
Well, and the issue with Shannon, who I know, and I believe Franz knows her quite well as well, she was playing at a level and trying a case at a level that's not something the general public can understand. So I don't blame the world for freaking out because she didn't match what they were expecting for a high profile. She didn't look like some Hollywood lawyer. From a trial perspective, she did great. Like trial perspective, she was authentic. She made people think. Remember how exactly hard these cases are. You're not going to trial because it's easy. These are people with really strong cases, people with really strong arguments, and they're not dumb. You can make fun of lawyers all the time. Very few of them are dumb.
So the big thing, and D, this is something I really want your listeners to hear. There is not a sea of people that try murder cases regularly. Like, there may be a guy or a gal that tries a whole bunch of DWI trials, but there's only a handful in most jurisdictions of attorneys that try murder cases on the regular. They are very, very difficult.
Is it that people, that lawyers wouldn't take it because it would be tough to win, or they don't take it because they just don't have the experience? So if somebody comes to you, like we've talked before that, you know, trying to measure the level of guilt, that sort of thing, where if you know the person did it, where if it comes in and it's kind of like a 50-50 situation, a lot of lawyers would just say, yeah, I can't do that. I'm not good enough.
So complexity, because you could have cases that have 20 to 30 witnesses. Duration, they take week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks. You could be in trial for a very long period of time.
Of 12-hour days every single day, yeah. 7 days.
Cash flow, a lot of private defendants don't have the money to hire private counsel. So if you're not a public defender, you're not trying those cases. You have to have a basic working knowledge of forensic science to deal with the forensic science pieces, to know when you're in over your head. It's tough. It is not easy. It's just not easy. And look, the physical and emotional wear of and tear, because you gotta understand, when Shannon tried that case, nobody's gonna convince me she didn't care about her client.
Oh yeah.
So the physical
years off her life.
Yeah, the physical wear and tear of watching your client get convicted is traumatic. It's just not something it's the big boy. It's the big boy table, right? Trying murder homicide cases. It is not for the weak.
And you kind of get into this weird thing with the population of people that do them, because there are just different approaches to each case. And that's going to impact what your service is like. Franz is absolutely right. Just the finances of a murder, you can spend $50,000 or $100,000 on experts in a murder before you've even started going. That's before a lawyer gets paid, anything like that. So depending on the complexity and the scope, most people just don't have the funds to buy that much lawyer time when you're talking about a private lawyer with the other stuff they can do.
I need $100,000 before we even get started.
If you walk into my office right now and are talking about a murder, the minimum, and I mean, if you're on video shooting him to death and just want to take a plea, you're talking $20,000, $30,000, $40,000. You want to actually contest this? We're going to talk $50,000 and it doubles, triples, quadruples relatively soon. There are a lot of lawyers who have an all murder practice, but because they only have four cases at a time. It's a very luxurious position.
Yeah.
It's just like some of the PI lawyers. We've got a good friend, Nelson, who does all dead baby cases. It's the only thing he does. They're the most emotional, horrifically gripping, awful, ridiculous cases in the world. He has less than a dozen of them. Every one of them is huge. But he doesn't care about answering the phone, originating business. No. He's got a dozen clients. That's it. And you can run that practice. At the same time, I know public defenders who try a couple murders a year, but hopefully they've got the support and backup for that. Because it just the orchestration of keeping it all together. You've got a dozen people on the defense. By the time you're done with staff and experts and witness, and you know, you can spend an enormous amount of time just getting people corralled to go to court.
And consider this. A public defender may be on his side of the table or her side of the table by themselves. Maybe they have an investigator. But the state generally has like two investigators, the secretary, the paralegal, the support staff. Understand, just corralling witnesses to make sure they're in the right space at the right time. Making sure, so as a public defender in a murder trial, you're making sure your client has plain clothes to wear.
That are
not too loose, not too tight, that don't make them look like they're basically Goodwill clothes. There's a lot of behind the scenes stuff.
And just to talk with your client, you can't just pick up the phone. No. You want to communicate with your client, you're talking a substantial predetermined amount of time is going to get erased from your day. Whether you're going to try to do a video visit that takes 24 or 48 hours to arrange and may not be at a convenient time for you, or they may not find you or whatever, or you got to go down to a jail and there's no jail in Georgia that you can get in, see a client and leave in less than an hour. It's never going to happen. You go in to visit somebody at a jail, you're talking to multiple people, there's moving around, there's security. So you can't call and be like, hey, this is the da-da-da-da. No, man. When you see them, that's it. You got to get everything in, then you pack up, then you do the work later on.
So I want to go back to a second, because you guys are talking about like actual stuff inside the courtroom and the people working. Franz just said in this particular case, he had a really good jury. I know you guys do your jury selections and all that. I know you guys have had that recently. Can you think of ones where you've had like a really bad jury selection where it's I already had my work cut out for me and now this has just gone from bad to worse?
You can pick a jury and see how it ends up. Because remember, jury selection is an exclusionary process. It's not I'm picking you because I like you. It's I'm kicking you off because I don't
like you.
And so it's inherently rejection-based. And then you've got a bunch of people hoping to get rejected, which is a whole nother weird thing. And then the pile of rejects get told, you have to go do this uncomfortable, serious work for no money. Everybody put a smile on your face and listen to this judge. It is not a high customer service happiness kind of thing.
you will see people's faces the moment they get selected from jury that you'll go, that person wants to convict anybody that's going to appear in front of them. Because you've run
why
out of
strikes.
Why
are we here?
Yeah.
Why are we here?
And remember, you can have jury panels that just have a lot of people who are pro one thing or anti another. And it can, we use the term, infect your jury pool. Because when you're doing the selection from the panels, you got 30, 40, 50 people. Franz and I both do a voir dire where we try to get people to talk and react so we can really see what their personality is like as much as anything else. You can have someone say something and then everybody else go, hell yeah. And then you're like, holy shit, I just disqualified or have a negative mark against half or three quarters of this jury. And that's great when I'm doing it to a DA and I've said, who has a bad experience with law enforcement or DUI or an arrest? And everybody's hand goes up and you're like, ha, ha, ha. You all hate the cops.
Yeah.
But you can have it go the other way as well, where it's, you know, who's been the victim of theft from homeless people? Who's, you know, who's been blamed for something that they, that somebody else did? Who's been defrauded? It gets really awful because it's group dynamics.
Yeah, wait till you hear someone say, I don't like criminal defense attorneys. I don't understand how you, because if someone says, I don't like a criminal defense attorney, that's not enough. You got to know why they don't like criminal defense attorneys. They have a bad experience. Are they unable to be fair and impartial? Can I get rid of them for cause? And then they tell you why they don't like criminal defense attorneys, which probably includes, I don't understand how you sleep at night representing people like that who's guilty. And you're just like, yeah,
and
a lot of people feel
that
way. And you
got to face it.
Yeah.
Because they're all judging your reaction. And if you're sitting there in your groove and going, all right, everybody, so I know this is really uncomfortable, but this case involves allegations of inappropriate sexual contact. Without telling me any details, does anybody have any personal experiences with boom? And you've got this person who just wants to talk about their very real, very painful, horrific experience. And
but you're thankful that they do that. You're thankful that they do that. Right? And look, it's not lost on us, by the way, it's not lost on us that there are people that have had terrible experiences that for them to talk about it in front of a large room of people, they're not trying to get out of jury selection. They just had a shitty hand dealt to them.
Yeah.
And God bless them for sharing that with you to let you know so that you aren't face with keeping someone that should never be on a jury in your trial.
Yep.
You know?
Well, I
and
guess
then there's the other,
I guess
the other person who just doesn't want to serve.
Sorry, I was going to say, I guess it's better that you do find that out because, again, just discussing jury selection, it does add another piece to the puzzle. So is it the defense attorney, like does the prosecution and the defense attorney have to agree on the juror, or it's kind of a one pick six sort of thing?
Nope. And it's different in state to state. We used to have an advantage here in Georgia where the defense got more strikes than the state, but we took that away. And what happens is, and every judge gets to tweak it a little bit themselves, you've got your panel of everybody, which is going to be a minimum in Georgia of about 30, 36 people. Very often you get multiple panels. And then you're going to go through voir dire. And then at some point, you're going to get to selection, and each side strikes one after another. Who are you going to strike? Who are you going to strike? Who are you going to strike? And the deputy walks back and forth between the tables until you get to the magic number. And those last 14 people, that's your 12 plus 2. That last 7 people, that's your 6 plus 1. That's your jury. And what you're doing is making sure that juror number 7 got kicked off because that guy was a real asshole, but you can't care about juror number 27 slipping through, even though I said some not great stuff. You really got to get rid of 14 and 27 before you get rid of 46, because 14, man, that one's off. And then you got the state cutting people out, and you don't know if they're going to cut somebody that you would cut. But again, it's an exclusion process, not an inclusion process.
So the art, the chess is, I don't want, so we call them peremptory challenges, right? I can get rid of somebody for any reason as long as it's not discriminatory. So I can't do race, gender, sexual, protected classes.
What I can do sometimes, and this is where the rubber meets the road, if you ask me, is I can play the game of, I don't want this person, but I want the prosecutor to get rid of them. So I will lead the prosecutor to believe that I love that person during my question answer exchange so that they use the peremptory exception. And then on top of all that, there is group dynamics concepts that you're like, okay, who's going to be, I try to pick the four person. Who's going to be the four person? And how is this person going to play in the sandbox with this person? Like, I don't want two strong attitudes and personalities. I don't want too weak, but I need some followers and I need a chief. And it gets to be very like,
well, it's and it complicated. Also depends on what your purpose of the jury is. Mm-hmm. From a criminal defense perspective, I don't want 6 or 12 people all singing Kumbaya and agreeing. Because
that a few angry like criminals.
Yeah, that sounds a lot like guilty. I want one or more of my jurors to go back with some fortitude and confidence and independence and say, hey, I connected to this part of the defense and I don't feel like the conviction should flow for this reason or not. And that's why, you know, one of our teachers talks about cleaving jurors, and we're literally out of the 6, 8, 10, 12 people, you will cleave 2, 3, 4 of them away into kind of a sub pod, and you can try a case directly at individual jurors if you know that that's going to be a value, including to the fact of, man, if I can make jurors dislike each other or dislike a particular thing and get emotionally attached to it so that they'll fight about it, that's awesome. I do not want happy jurors in a criminal case on the defense.
So
absolutely
remember,
different from personal injury and right. plaintiff's work where they're all trying to get these disparate people to love each other.
So remember, this is the most unlawyerly thing we do. Jury selection is the most unlawyerly thing we do. We're talking to people and trying to extract information in a non-manipulative way because they can smell manipulation, right? And on top of that, you sometimes have to do shit that's like, I can't tell you how many times I've had cases where my client confessed and I just stand up and I'm like, look, when I got hired on this case, one of the first things I learned, and you're going to learn it too, is my client confessed. And when I heard that, I'm like, why are we even having a trial?
Yeah.
And like, there are people that are like, yeah, that's a good question. And then there are people that are like, well, wait a minute. I want to know more. Like, was it a free and voluntary confession? Were they being forced to confess? And I'm like, no, guys. And then you're doubling down. You're like, no, guys. He confessed. That's a way. It's a waste of your time. And I'm sorry. And you have to like do ballsy things. And like, meanwhile, the prosecutor or the judge who doesn't know how to pick a jury is like looking at you like, what the hell is Franz doing? What the hell is Josh doing?
He just
doing?
Gave up.
Yeah. I mean, is this malpractice? You know?
And really, jury selection is the ultimate exercise of basic American prejudice and bigotry and discriminate. You're making very quick decisions based on almost no information on other people.
Your job is to judge a book by its cover.
Yeah.
Which we're not supposed to do.
You get given a list. It's like, his name's Franz. He's a lawyer. He's age 45. He lives in Baton Rouge. So you go through the list. It's like, well, Steve sells insurance. I probably don't want him on this kind of case. Oh, Judy is a school teacher. And you learn these BS tropes where it's like, oh, man, you never want teachers on a criminal jury. You never want old white men on that. You never want young black women on. Like, there's all these ridiculous, super prejudiced, bias-based tricks and tips. And that's how a lot of people select jurors. Because you have to rely on your prejudices to select a jury.
Well, I guess depending on the case too, I mean, I guess because the jury selection is random. So you're not getting, I don't want to say you're not getting super smart people, but.
What do you mean by random?
Random in the sense that in my state, it's based on voter registration and driver's license.
Same here.
That creates certain economic, socioeconomic questions now, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I've had jury pools with lawyers. I've had jury pools with judges. I've had jury pools with cops, doctors.
Wouldn't that get automatically chucked though? Like that's
no.
And in fact,
got to burn the strike.
And in fact, it is patently unconstitutional
to just exclude somebody for that very reason. Look, you could have someone that is hearing and visually impaired, and you have to some degree, accommodate them.
And remember,
you can't just get rid of them.
You can still try to get rid of potential jurors for cause. And because if a juror says something that would prohibit them from being fair and impartial, either side or the judge can say, hey, we want to strike number 14 for cause. But then the other side might not want that person struck for cause because they might really like that cause.
Yeah.
And then you have to deal with whether you can rehabilitate a juror, which is basically asking them, so I know you said that you're super evil and racist and pro this and anti that. Can you be fair? And shockingly, as long as the person goes, oh, yeah, no, I can set that aside and be fair and impartial.
I mean,
you're rehabilitated.
I mean, yeah, I have a Ku Klux Klan family member that stays at my house and I wash and iron his yeah, robe and hood, but I can put that to the side. I got a lot of black friends.
You know,
you will see the most extraordinary mental gymnastics with rehabilitating jurors, which then is basically telling the juror, one of these lawyers hates you. That lawyer really likes you before the trial has even started.
See, in my opinion, from what I've seen, again, you guys have probably obviously seen a lot more of it. The hardest thing for me to do would be when somebody says, you know, can you stricken that and just the jury disregard that?
Because it's complete garbage.
Because
if Josh,
if either one of you guys talked for a week and said a million words and then somebody told me to not pay attention to 30 seconds of it, that's all I'm going to remember.
So now you're getting into how the game's played, because when you see lawyers say stuff that is knowingly objectionable,
yeah,
and they just whip it out knowing that Franz is going to stand and go, I object, and the judge is going to go, sustain,
yeah,
you'll disregard that. Doesn't matter. Toothpaste out of the tube, brother. And that's how, if you really want to put your thumb on the scale, lawyers do that intentionally, which is unethical, all the time.
Yeah,
my favorite.
They knowingly put up evidence that should not be... And that's just part of the game.
My favorite, and I've gotten scolded for it, is when a judge or a prosecutor will stand up and say, your decision is not supposed to in any way be based on emotion. And I will stand up in jury selection and say, Mr. Smith, are you a robot? Can you turn your emotions off and on like with a switch? Yeah, like the judge is telling you not to make this decision based on emotion. But by the way, that goes into the calculus of judging truthfulness, judging credibility, you know, like making decisions about whether or not the state proved its case or not. We're not cyborgs. And like, boy, oh boy, again, judge is like, Mr. Borkhart, what are you saying? I'm saying, judge, what you're asking is, it's like you telling me not to think about breathing. What am I immediately going to think about? Breathing?
Yeah. It's your birthday, but I don't want you to think about getting a year older, and I don't want anyone to say happy birthday to you.
as sacred and solemn as our court system is, the parts of it that are just utter bullshit are laughable. Jury instructions. We spend so much time, like charge conferences, you'll get into knockdown, drag-out battles over word selection, all to be part of a 10-20-page document that's read only to a bunch of sleepy jurors in the afternoon, and they're never allowed to hear it again and can't check it.
Right.
And those are the rules for the case. And then after a juror does their ruling and comes back, the lawyers, without talking to them, then get to complain to the Court of Appeals and go, juries didn't understand this then. No wonder. You read it to them once. It's legalese. It was in the middle of a 75-paragraph document, and you're upset that they screwed up, you know, some minor issue. That's appeals.
Mangino, I'll get off of this in one sec, but I know when I talked with Matthew Mangino, he told me a really good one that when he was working as a prosecutor, you know, he said, yeah, I had this thing down. He goes, but I could just tell that this one juror, he's sort of falling asleep. He goes, when he would talk, the guy wasn't paying attention. He was kind of simple, this, that, and the other thing. And he was like, I'm going to bet you that's the foreperson. And sure enough, it was. He's like, this guy hasn't paid attention to 90% of the shit that I'm saying, and he's in charge.
So let me say this. Josh and I are both graduates of a trial lawyer's college. And I took a break from the college for a while because I was a prosecutor for a while. And you can't be a member of the college while you're a prosecutor, right?
So I, after getting done being a prosecutor and trying a few cases as a prosecutor, the common question I was asked is, well, what was it like being a prosecutor and what was the hardest part? And I said, and I still believe, the hardest part about trying cases as a prosecutor is it's very hard to measure your abilities and successfulness as a prosecutor because you're supposed to win, right? So like picking a jury during, as a prosecutor, I mean, I'm the white knight. I'm the defender of the public and all this. And I'm cherry picking which cases I bring. And in fact, it almost becomes a game of not losing instead of wanting to win, right?
That's exactly what it is. It's a fear-driven practice because technically state can just reduce the charges and try only the easy part. Yeah, you know, the murder may be hard, but we sure as hell can prove he shot him. It's real easy to prove a shooting as opposed to a murder sometimes.
Yeah, you pick the ones you want. So you're like, Franz Borchardt is 150-0 because he when never they talk took a about
federal, when they talk about federal prosecutions, the feds put more into every prosecution than you could possibly believe because they're going to make it so hard to win. But that's because they didn't do 50 cases. They did one. And that's really it. It's assets and it's resource allocation. And everybody gets pissed off because if you were robbed of only a couple million dollars in a fraud and go talk to the FBI, they're going to say, oh, it's just a couple million dollars. We don't have space for it. It's way too small. We only deal with fraud cases once they reach 5 million or 10 million. But then you go to the local prosecutors and they go, whoa, 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 that's more than $20,000. That's a federal case.
Before we get to a hot dog chat, I know this Robin,
a recurring segment,
this Robin Howington situation. A lot of people were wondering what is the difference between a homicide and a reckless homicide, and why is the sentencing so different?
So oversimplification answer, it's the difference between specific intent, which is I want to kill you, I think about killing you, and I kill you, versus what I'll call a gross negligence. Like my behavior was so much of a gross deviation of standard of care that it becomes criminally liable in nature.
So how is it different from first degree murder to third degree murder?
So first degree murder. So first degree murder, I want to kill you. I think about killing you, and maybe there's some aggravated factors in there that will put me in a position where I can be put to death. Gross negligence, because I didn't want to kill you. I didn't think about killing you, but I was so ridiculous in my behavior that it was grossly negligent. The penalty comes way down, still a felony, still a homicide, but comes way down. The exposure becomes way down. In some states, it's not even a crime of violence. Gross negligent homicide is not even a crime of violence. So, for example, our girl in the Russ set, what's her name?
Haley
Gutierrez.
Gutierrez. Yeah, she's looking at 0 to 18 months.
Yeah,
I want to talk involuntary about that, manslaughter.
We have to talk about that when we have a little bit more time because there's a lot to unravel there.
But it gets down to what Franz is really talking about, which is the intent concept. You can do a bunch of dumb stuff and not intend someone to die, but someone did die. That could be a negligent homicide, but if your actions were so grossly negligent to rise above just negligence to reckless, that there's a difference between me being negligent and me being reckless. Negligent is I look down at my phone and rear end someone. Reckless is I'm pounding shots and taking my, like, but it's not that easy. There's not this mathematical equation. It's the squishiness of facts. But when you get down to how someone died and what actions were the causal connection or nexus with that, you can really get granular with the intent. I meant to shoot at that building thinking it was empty. I didn't know it had a bunch of kids in it. I only wanted to take that action to stop them from chasing me. I didn't know it would kill them. I was just driving that car being reckless for me. I didn't know that someone else was going to be affected by it, and how they were affected can indicate whether it was just negligence or it was reckless. And that's why it really is a case-by-case basis.
And what we are seeing, a trend, a national trend right now, is we are starting to see an influx of prosecutions for what we will call gross negligent murders, prosecuting parents of the school shooter, prosecuting the armor smith, prosecuting Alec Baldwin, prosecuting a kid in a hazing death. We're starting to see an influx of prosecuting a cop that doesn't run into the fray of a shooting. We didn't used to see all this. Like, negligent homicide used to be like something else. And now it's this Good Samaritan in action law.
Yeah. It used to be like you left a baby in a car. And now it's this one where you have to unravel this onion that just seems to go on forever.
We've expanded that net of who can fit in. The big one that we're talking about here in Georgia with our year-old favorite felony murder rule is Franz is a dope dealer. Franz sells some dope. He doesn't know that it's a hot dose, and he doesn't know shit about the person buying it. He's selling dope. Now, two situations. One, Franz sells some fentanyl, ends up killing some kids at a club. Now, lots of people are going to say that's felony murder because while Franz didn't intend for them to die, he committed a felony by selling them dope, and that dope, no fault of Franz or anybody else, was a hot dose and killed people. Now, in Georgia, that's a pretty strong felony murder rule. And that's getting tried left, right, and center. At the same time, you've got some more distant causal issues like we see in Michigan, where it's, well, you bought a person a gun, but you didn't see how foreseeable it was that they were going to go commit crimes. That's on that spectrum as well. And there's just so many different permutations of how do we get to that death or crime, and can you wrap people up? We've got another one where it's a kid driving away from the police. He's just fleeing. He's just trying to run away from the police. Fortunately, cop wrecks his car while chasing him and dies.
Yeah, we have.
Yeah, that's felony murder.
We have cop high speed chases someone fleeing. Someone, kills a civilian, kills somebody. Cop is now charged with negligent homicide. Now, fleeing person is charged with second degree murder, right? Understand, I'm not saying there's not a civil component to all of this. There is.
Absolutely.
We are criminalizing activity that traditionally was more civil in nature, which we've always been able to do, but we haven't seen it done on this level. And I don't know exactly why it is. Other than I think that there's this sense of we have to hold everybody accountable, even if they're not really accountable. Look, I ain't going to lose any sleep over the Rust armor smith. I will say I watched a lot of that trial, and that bitch, I'm going to say it, that bitch was railroaded and scapegoated.
Yeah, I think that was the goal from the get-go, and now it'll be a money thing, and then that'll be it. But we said
It's always a money thing. Let me get back to what Franz was just saying. We see this in infusion and injection into our criminal process. I believe firmly that comes out of the civil universe because there are more new creative civil liability causes of action that get broader and deeper. And that now has inspired a bunch of prosecutors to do the same thing and expand and go deeper with some of the criminal possibilities out there. Because statutes are vague means that you can put a lot of stuff into them. And that's when you see, like, Walt Nauta's motion in Cannon's case for Trump, the overly vague. We've got some criminal laws out there you can pack all kinds of crazy behavior into. And some of them are pretty serious. Some of them are meant to be really broad and open, like disorderly conduct. You can fit all kinds of crap into there. But that's because it's also a misdemeanor. But the bigger cases are aggravated assault. Aggravated assault in Georgia traditionally meant you needed some sort of tool, a bat, a gun, a knife. Now your hands count. We have the Georgia ruling that says your hands are a deadly weapon. And if you choke with them, that's aggravated assault. So what did we get? 5 years of every DV that they wanted to turn into a felony suddenly had choking alleged, even with no proof, pictures, anything else. The officer knew that if he put choke in there, it went to automatic felony, and that was less paperwork for them.
Because we are experiencing felonies,
the DAs do the work on misdemeanors, the cop does.
So going back to something Josh said, we are experiencing in Louisiana, not just the drug dealer who sells the fentanyl-laced drugs, but let's say Franz just gives his friend something, because that's what you do. Maybe he passes something or a hot dog, and there's fentanyl in there. Now, Franz is not the central drug dealer, but technically, hyper-technically, by giving narcotics to somebody else, he's distributing drugs. We all agree with that. Franz is now being prosecuted for murder, felony murder, for the death of the friend that he gave the drugs to. And we all agree Franz is not the central drug dealer. And now we all agree Franz had no way of knowing that there was fentanyl in there.
Now, let's compare that to a nurse at a school giving a kid a medicine that they didn't have knowledge the kid was allergic to. Kid dies. Is that nurse guilty of something? Man, there's some real cool stuff you can do with that and putting a nurse in prison and ruining their life.
Does
that come down to, sorry, we're going to get to the hot dog in a sec, but with all these things that you were talking about with them stepping up the, I know you got five, with just, with people stepping up these charges and all that sort of thing, does it, as like a lot of the other cases we talked to, does it boil down to how much defense can the person afford? So, yeah. You know, if you have this complicated fentanyl case, that sort of thing, and you have $250,000 to drop on a lawyer.
It is hard to convince someone who doesn't understand why they are criminally liable for something that is gross negligence. It's hard to convince them to plead to a felony. Because right. Oftentimes these people don't have felony records. They're not quote unquote criminals by nature. They don't think they did anything wrong. The nurse scenario that Josh just threw out, I could see a nurse making an argument for, I didn't do anything wrong. Of course I gave this child penicillin. That's the standard operating procedure, right? Or I didn't run into the school shooting because I didn't know where the shooter was and I was in a defensive posture. It is hard to convince those people to plead guilty to anything. Those are the cases that are getting tried. We cover those on a national platform because they don't have a clear answer to them. Like, it's easy. You shot up the school. You're a school shooter. You shot up the school. You're going to go away either for life or for some period of time. But it ain't a whodunit, right? The negligence crimes are more difficult. And because of that, because those cases are necessitate trying, it's not about the expense. It's about having someone who can handle something that is a non-traditional criminal case where I might be arguing something that I never argue in a specific intent crime, which is intervening causation. I might be saying, yeah, my client did X, Y, and Z, but there's some other thing that happened that it wouldn't have mattered if he did it or not. It would have caused the death. That's a very refined nuance.
All right, we have 5 minutes and we are doing hot dogs, but
okay.
Put down the concept of strict liability for a future podcast. Liability, really
I'm going to put strict liability on the shelf now. I know Franz is important about the bun, and he doesn't care if the hot dog's been sitting there for a week, but we're going to talk about topic.
Yeah. Bun's got to be good.
And I believe Franz went first last week. So, Josh, and now just toppings, what is going your number one pick for what goes on a hot dog or a hamburger? Mainly a hot dog.
Absolutely mustard. Absolutely mustard. I'm not anti-ketchup, but there's 100% going to be mustard on it. I'm a giant onion fan.
Hold on. Franz gets to go next.
Oh, sorry.
So now you're going to steal onions.
No. So I am a huge fan of beanless chili. Beanless as initial topping.
I believe they call it straight chili. It's a Texas thing, right?
Yeah, but no beans. No beans.
No, chili hot dog topping. Yeah. It's, fine grind, almost like a paste.
Josh, I think you're taking onions number two.
Yeah, onions of all shapes.
Okay, Franz, you have chili paste as your number one. What is your number two?
So I do a mustard mayo combo.
Did mayo? Mayo would have been my first pick.
No. I don't want mustard or mayo. I want mustard and mayo mixed together into a yellowish whitish substance.
Classic lawyer move. Getting two toppings for the price of one.
And that goes on top of the chili.
You want a mustard aioli on top of the chili.
Yes. Oh, just buckle up, baby. It's about to get even better.
Now, so now we can shift gears. What do you think about coleslaw? Because I love a good coleslaw dog, but you can't have coleslaw with a bunch of other stuff. Coleslaw kind of is a primary ingredient.
Sauerkraut.
Similar. Sauerkraut, really awesome with mustard. Don't put a bunch of weird crap on top of my sauerkraut. I want my sauerkraut.
Yeah, I'm with you on that.
So whose pick is it now?
Bronze, Josh's? Your third pick.
Okay. I want melted cheese, not floury shredded cheese, because shredded cheese normally has flour on it. I don't like that way that tastes.
It,
I want to either...
starch, yeah.
Yeah, whatever. I either have to shred it myself, or I need it melted and poured on top of the mustard, mayo, chili concoction.
All right, point of order. Are you talking about pre-melted nacho cheese, or are you talking about cheese that's been melted and put on a hot dog?
Cheese in a can.
The nacho cheese.
So here it is. If I have the wherewithal at my own house, I want cheese that I can blowtorch and make a crispy, like...
100%. Extra sharp cheddar, torch it, crispy, 100% there.
Josh, because your last pick.
Last?
Yeah, we only do four.
Last?
Last.
That's a weak hot dog. Four ingredients, that's a weak
hot
dog.
So far, you have mustard, onions, and coleslaw.
Do I have to eat these all together? Because that's not the perfect hot dog by any means.
You don't have to eat them together. It's just who did it best.
Yeah, because really, a chili slaw dog with mustard is good. But you wouldn't necessarily add a lot of cheese to that. But a chili slaw dog, that's a classic.
That's what I'm saying.
Let's see. Chili, coleslaw, onions, mustard, ketchup's a given. Oh, I'll tell you what I've been eating at my local Roller Food Emporium.
Let's go.
I like the raw jalapeno.
Oh, yes.
But I've gotten into the
you beat me to
jalapeno. And I love pickled jalapeno. I love hot the raw biting.
Brilliant.
Man, that's good stuff on a hot dog.
There's a joint around there I hear that does that with a whole portobello mushroom on the burger with the jalapenos and all that sort of thing. And it just,
I love the influence of jalapenos on American culinary society. We've accepted spice over the last 10, 15 years. Like nothing. It's been great.
So last for me is I'm going to open up a jar of red chili paste.
Red
not
chili.
A lot.
Like
sambal? Asian. Yeah. Not sriracha, but I will use sriracha in a pinch.
Sambal, yeah.
Yeah, and just put a little light amount on top of the crusted cheese, which is on top of the mayo mustard, which is on top of the chili.
Not talking about that fancy chili crisp. He's talking about sambal.
I have chili crisp and sambal.
crisp is great. It's a hipster fad that will disappear. Sambal.
True fact about Franz that you and the viewers don't know, or listeners don't know, when I'm really stressed out, I will go to a local Asian market and just wander the aisles and try to find stuff that is so off the chain so that I can cook with it.
That's the place to go. The other place to go for more Josh and Franz, maybe you need a lawyer, maybe you need advice, maybe you were fired for God knows what we were talking about today. Check out Joshua Schiffer at jdgrouplaw.com or on Twitter at Lawyer Schiff, or just Google Joshua Schiffer. For an extra helping of Franz in Louisiana, visit www.borghartlawfirm.com, on Twitter at Borghart Law, or just use the old international network and Google it, or reach out to me. Gentlemen, thank you so much. Have a great day, and big show next week. Let's go.
Can't wait. Thanks so much.
Bye, guys.
Bye, y'all.